ask for what you want with no fear because nothing bad is going to happen. I like no one handed me $400,000, right? Like I've advocated for myself very strongly in my one-on-one meetings with managers. Like I'm managing them. I'm saying, this is what I want here, so I'm going to get there. You know, how are you going to help me do this? I know how to have those conversations, but I'm not their boss. I have to be able to influence them without having authority over them. And like I use a ton of my litigation skill sets and being able to do that, right? And so I use my litigation skill sets every single day. I think it is the most valuable experience that I had, even though I ultimately, you know, didn't like it for a lot of reasons, not only the culture, but you know, there were a lot of things about litigation that didn't end up just, you know, syncing up for me. But I still think it's a really, really valuable place to start out.
Hello and welcome to episode 437 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Ben Olson. I'm one of the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. For all of you who just finished the January LSAT, congratulations. Let us know how it went, good or bad. You can always share news and ask questions on our website. That's thinkinglsat.com. Coming up next week, Wednesday, January 24th, Nathan is going to be hosting a free class that's his double black diamond class. It just consists of some of the hardest logical reasoning questions our students encounter. They get to nominate those questions and then he ends up doing them in class. It's free, so it's free for everyone. All you need is a Demon free account. You can sign up for that at lsatdemon.com. Today, we have special guest Jonea Gordon. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You're a data privacy expert. You're
Yes.
an attorney. You're
Yes.
also a privacy leader at Amazon and an adjunct professor at Temple University's law school.
Right.
Before you were at Amazon, you led privacy programs at tech giants like Facebook, Reality Labs, and Google. You have experience in privacy issues for artificial intelligence, machine learning, and augmented reality. That sounds pretty cutting edge.
It's fun.
Wow, that's what everybody's talking about these days.
Right.
Now, before you were working as a privacy lawyer, you were a litigation attorney at a mid-sized firm in Philadelphia. I'm sure we'll get into much more, but is there anything you want to add to that introduction?
I would add just personally that I have two young children and also find time between all of the things you mentioned to also be a ceramic artist. So you can have a full life as a lawyer. You can do many things and have
you
a
don't
life.
Have to just be a machine.
Okay. Right, exactly.
That's awesome. How old are your kids?
I have a 5-year-old and an 18-month-old.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's got to keep you busy.
Yeah.
Okay, well, great. Well, so I will say, I reached out to you because my dad just consumes articles, multiple articles daily. And then he sends me some of those articles that he thinks that I'll be interested in. One of them was an article that you wrote for, or I guess you were interviewed maybe for Business
Right.
Insider.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. And that just came out in December of 23. And I guess I don't know if this was the title of the article, but it was very long. So I can't imagine this is the title, but it said, I got a tech job and quadrupled my salary to $400,000 after leaving law. You don't need a traditional tech background to succeed in the industry. I thought a lot of what you said in that article. Again, I don't know. Is that the actual title? That is like such a long title.
Maybe that
yes,
is the title.
I think that is the headline that Business Insider came up with. And it is a mouthful. And I had no input into that, but that's what it says, I think.
Okay. Well, if anyone wants to find it, they can find it. They can search for you and Business Insider. But anyways, I thought you had a lot of good things to say. I just immediately thought of our audience because so many people, they want to go to law school. They want to practice law. They have no clue what they're getting into. And so there's that audience, right? And so we're always telling people, don't go to law school unless you know what the heck you're doing. And if you are going to go, don't pay at all or don't pay nearly as much as you think you should pay. And anyways, so you're someone who went to law school, you became an attorney, and then you decided, hey, this is not for me, and you left, but you've still kind of gone into this route that's very legal adjacent, right? So anyways, I thought people would want to hear your story, and go from there. So anyways, let's step back a little bit. What brought you to go to law school to pursue a legal career?
Right. So probably the same thing that a lot of your listeners are thinking about when thinking about law school. And for me, the decision to go to law school is motivated by money and impact. You know, I envisioned myself being financially secure as a young professional. And honestly, the way that my experience went in undergrad is that I was initially a journalism major, and I was really into journalism. And in high school, I was on the editorial board of my high school newspaper, you know, from freshman year all the way through. It was a little bit like, I describe it like Glee, but for newspapers, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
okay.
it was a lot of my whole personality. It wasn't just a career that I wanted to do. Yeah. And I actually, in my senior year of high school, I entered a program where I was able to go to community college instead. And I completed all of my first year college classes in my senior
year. Wow. So you skipped senior year of high school and you just went straight.
Yeah, I went for two classes in the morning, AP English and journalism. And then I left and went to community college every day.
So you were serious. You were like, I'm here to do school.
Right. And so the benefit of that is when I then went to college at Temple University in Philadelphia, I had the normal freshman experience in the freshman dorms, right? Mm. But my classes were not freshman classes. I wasn't taking English 101 and so forth. And I immediately went into journalism courses and immediately realized that, from all the amazing professors who I had with these great backgrounds, one of the things that stood out to me is that this career is a gamble. And there are really great journalists out there who don't always make it on TV or make it really big. And I made a decision that that's not a gamble I want to take. I knew that more than anything, I wanted financial security, really. And so I very matter-of-factly changed my major to political science and philosophy, which was the pre-law track at Temple University, and decided I'm going to law school. Had never met a lawyer in my life and was really motivated by what we see on TV about lawyers pretty much doing well and respected and having impact. And that's how the decision was made for me.
If I'm hearing you correctly, you were going to pursue this journalism path and then you decided, okay, this is not as glamorous or as potentially successful as I think it might be. So law. Was there a lot of thought into going into law, or was it just, I don't want to do journalism, and then law became like a default answer?
Well, you know, I think if you asked me at 18, was there a lot of thought, my answer would be, sure, I thought about this. But if you ask me now, I did not really think about it. You know, one of the classes that you have to take in journalism is political science. And I was in this political science class and I loved it. And I was at the point where I'm thinking of what else I can do, because by the end of that first semester of my freshman year, which was really my sophomore year, I really was internalizing this gamble that I was taking of maybe having to spend 10 years, doing things I really don't want to do to get the types of journalism work that I think is fun and glamorous. Right. And so if you asked me then, I would have said, sure, I thought this all the way through. I loved that poli sci class. But in reality, no, I did not. I did love that class. And I really enjoyed my studies in political science and philosophy. Loved learning about all that stuff. Still love philosophy a ton right now. But no, it was very matter of fact, you know, and it was really motivated by money. And I think it's okay for us to admit that. It's okay for us to say that. That's why we want to do it. It's a fantastic motivator.
Yeah, certainly. What do you think about, is that expectation of money consistent with reality?
No. It is not. I mean, it is at, Am Law 100 law firms, right? You
Yeah.
know, there are certain things that you can do right from
Yep.
law school where you're going to immediately make, $150,000, $60,000, $70,000 as a first year associate. And, but I, the time that I graduated from law school was very closely aligned with the, Great Recession, right? And
Okay.
so
Yeah.
I got a big dose of reality when I went to law school, right? In the early thousands, you graduated from law school and you just chose your law firm, right?
Yeah,
And
yeah.
my law school graduating class, I remember this, and this wasn't unique, but I think the employment rate on graduation day was something like 54%, which means that the other, 46% didn't have job secured at graduation. And that was unheard of in the
Wow.
early
Yeah.
thousands. And it wasn't unique to Temple University. That was happening everywhere because, law firms were canceling their entire summer associate classes and first year associate classes. So I don't know exactly how it's rebounded. I don't think it is similar to what it was like in the early thousands, where there's just job offers from Am Law 100 firms raining down on anyone everywhere. I think it's somewhere in the middle. I think it's better than when I graduated, but never went back to that, those glory days that are reminiscent of what you think of, Wall Street in the 1990s, right?
Yeah. Well, I think and not that we're experts in employment outcomes by any means, but when you think about the employment outcomes that people are looking at, of course, so much of it depends on, okay, where did you go to law school? And then also, where did you end up in your class? And depending on that situation for each student, it's vastly different what your experience is. So many people, like you said, are walking out of law school with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, or at least tens of thousands of dollars in debt, and no job prospect, right? Or at least in the traditional sense.
Right. And I would add that there's a third factor there, right? It's, your job prospects are where'd you go to school and how well did you do? But also, I think that the one consideration there that law students and, college students who are thinking of going to law school don't really, really appreciate is what do you want to do? What do you envision your lifestyle being like? I know a lot of people who got into big law firms, myself included, after a long journey, and immediately said, "No way! I don't want to be spoken to like this by my colleagues or opposing counsel, and I don't want to bill these hours. I don't want to work on week. I want to take vacations." And those are real things that are really important in life. I'm sure, you can appreciate that as well. But very often, that's just something like, and that was my thought process too. Like, oh, if it's money, I'll work all weekend. I don't need
How much do I
vacations.
get paid? Okay, I'll do
Right.
that. Yeah.
And that is not the reality. A lot of people end up miserable, and they end up either just staying miserable for their entire careers. And I know a lot of people who didn't leave the law firms and are just still miserable. And others who, don't feel like they fit that hold, they are just confused after, because you go through law school thinking law school or the practice of law is big law, and you realize you don't want to do that, and you have a little bit of an existential crisis in, an early part of your life of what do I want to do really, and what are the options?
Wow. So there's really these two big hurdles, right? One, are you even going to get a job that pays as much as you expect you're going to get paid when you're leaving law school? And two, even if you do, how are you going to react to that job despite the fact that you're getting paid these big dollars, right? How quickly did you realize, no, this is not what I want to be doing?
I probably realized it when I was a summer associate. So I
So
got an
before,
offer.
when you were in law school.
Yeah, when I was in law school, I was a summer associate. I worked at a law firm called Weber Gallagher. As you mentioned, it's a mid-sized firm in Philadelphia. I was grateful to have a job at all, and I really enjoyed the work that the firm did. And so I was a summer associate there, and I was the only summer associate to get an offer to come back, because once again, things were just really hard back then to get a job. So they gave me the offer at the beginning of my third year of law school. I accepted it, which was a good way to go through that third year of law school. But I ended up, they also offered me to work there during law school. So in that third year, I spent about 20 hours a week, you know, doing paid work at the firm, got to know everyone really well. But it was probably in the middle of that year where I was like, uh-oh. Like, I don't think I want to do this. I'm not enjoying this. And it wasn't the people. But I, you know, went through with it and I had a lot to learn and I was learning a lot. Ultimately, I think the decision, I made the firm decision that it wasn't for me after about like a solid year of practicing, you know, post graduating after taking the bar and really being an associate attorney. I think it took about 1 year for me to say, I really don't think that I want to do this.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
You said earlier, you said, I don't want to be spoken to like this. Do you want to talk more about that?
Definitely. And this is the part where, you know, that I think, you know, students can't, like, it's hard to weigh this factor, especially if you're a student like me who never worked before. I went straight from college to law school, so I didn't have any work experience. But, you know, there's a certain way, there's a certain culture in law firms. There's a Reddit page that like I still follow for some reason. I don't know why, but I love Reddit. And if anyone's interested in Big Law and wants to know about the culture, I highly recommend the Big Law, like, you know, page on Reddit.
So the subreddit is Big Law.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the subreddit. And you'll get an understanding of the culture because the questions people ask there are frankly bizarre to anyone else in the world because you have to sometimes be okay with someone speaking to you disrespectfully and extremely passive aggressively and trying to get information from people who don't do a great job of giving you the information and receiving negative feedback in a way that's not entirely constructive because that's just how the practice of law goes, right? I mean, we've all heard stories, I think, of someone turning in a brief to a partner and the partner throwing it in the garbage can, right? Yeah, I haven't had that exact...
Redo.
right. And I haven't had that exact thing happen. Like I won't like, you know, dramatize my experience. Like I never walked into my partner's office and he ripped it in half and threw it in the garbage can. But I've had similarly deflating experiences in receiving feedback. And and it's not that the feedback was wrong. I was a young attorney. I had no idea what I was doing. My briefs were probably terrible. There's a way of working and being spoken to and communicating in law firms that can be hard for people who don't naturally communicate that way. And it can require you to act all day in that role. And you have to decide, do I want to be this person from 9 to 5? Or do I want to be who I am from 9 to 5 if that's not who you really are?
Yeah. Is this a persona I want to take on? You said 9 to 5, but is that...
No, that's not real. I meant also on Saturday and Sunday. Right? Yeah.
And after 5 and before 9. Yeah, okay.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you want to become this person or is this... Yeah. So then what did you do? I mean, you're like, okay, you made the decision. You said, hey, where's the eject button?
Yeah, right. And so, you know, I mentioned already that I, you know, went straight from undergrad to law school and that I, you know, completed high school a little bit early. So I'm very young at this point, right? I am 24. I've already been a practicing attorney for a year. And I first went through a lot of my connections. I'd been in Philadelphia for a while. I was the president of the Black Law Student Association at Temple. And so I had a lot of legal connections. And my first thing when you want a new job is you apply to new jobs, right? So I went through my network. I told everyone I'm looking for a new job and I got some interviews at other firms. And frankly, after about 3 months of interviewing, I just decided I don't want to do this. Like, I don't even want to work at these other firms. I don't.
Oh, so you thought maybe the problem was just your firm and you're like, I'll laterally move to some other nicer, greener pasture. Okay.
Exactly. And honestly, in that interview process, I did the thing, you know, the song and the dance. I wore my navy blue suits. I went to lunch at fancy places with white tablecloths and, you know, did all the things. And, I just realized I don't want to do this at all, you know, and I had that revelation and it was devastating to me having worked so hard to, you know, get through law school because, you know, I went to the top trial advocacy law school in the country. And what that means is that you come out mostly knowing how to do that and not a ton else. And at least that's the track that I chose. And
Yeah.
so I just really had tunnel vision around litigation and wasn't aware of what my other options were. So it was a little bit scary, you know, when I made that decision, but it was also clear to me that from a lifestyle standpoint, that's not how I wanted to live my life.
Yeah. Not going to work. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Did you end up quitting, or did you first and then find another
Yeah.
path, or did you find a path and then quit?
Right. So I got scrappy at this point. I didn't have another job lined up because I didn't know what else to do. And so I got a real estate license and said,
Okay.
look, I'm just going to think this through a little bit. And I got a real estate license. I sold real estate for about a year and a half. Frankly, I was really successful selling real estate. Like I mean, most people sell real estate in the first year. They don't even sell a house. I think I sold like 20 houses in my first year. I was killing it
Wow.
because I
Okay.
was selling to all my classmates and my,
Yeah.
like, but after
All
about
these people you know who have the salary to, yeah, okay. I got the house for you. Yeah,
right.
great.
But frankly, after about 15 months, when I had to actually do the work to get clients, I was like, this isn't working out for me. I don't know how to sell real estate, right? So I
Yeah.
had a really good like 15 months of like figuring out my life selling real estate to frankly a ton of my friends and like law firm associates. And
Yeah.
after that, I said, look, I want to do something law related. This at this point, I'm still like 25, right? And said, I don't know what I want to do, but I know after having thought about this and that I want to be adjacent to law. And I went into legal recruiting and
Okay.
figured that's a great
Yeah.
place to continue meeting people and making connections, and maybe I'll find what I want to do. I was legal recruiting for 3 years at an agency. I became the branch manager of that agency, and I had a team of about 25 recruiters working under me. And I got exposure to so many different types of law, and one of those types of law was privacy. That's how I became introduced to privacy, is that a lot of my clients were needing privacy attorneys. And in order for me to find the right attorney for an open job, I have to really understand what the job requires. So as I'm getting deeper and deeper into understanding all these areas of law, you know, from real estate to intellectual property and privacy, I really just gravitated towards privacy. And after a while, I decided it's what I wanted to do. I did a lot of networking before making the change, but ultimately, after about 6 months of networking in the industry, I leveraged that network to get my first job. It was a pay cut for me after having done so well as a recruiter. So I started out at a consulting firm called Protiviti, and from there, I was in privacy. That was about 6 years ago, and I
But
absolutely
that
love it.
wasn't practicing, right? It was legal. It was like JD adjacent job. Okay. Yeah.
So I was in consulting. You know, Protiviti is a large consulting firm,
Yeah.
and all the consulting firms, you know, have privacy practices, everything from BCG and McKinsey to PwC and KPMG, Deloitte, right? They have robust privacy practices, and they hire and seek out JDs for those positions as well. So that's one of the roles that I was able to secure, was a senior consultant position in a consulting practice, which is a lot like law in terms of the way that you get work and work with clients in different industries, but is in a consulting firm as opposed to the law firm environment.
Interesting. When I think of privacy, I just imagine a massive area, right? There's so many issues that could fall under that. When you went there, what kind of problems were you trying to solve?
So at that time, this is, you know, 2017, 2018, this was a time when privacy was frankly a lot less mature than it is now, even though it's just 6 years. It's been a big 6 years. And there was a new regulation at that time called the General Data Protection Regulation, which we refer to as the GDPR. And all of my
Okay.
work was based on getting companies compliant with this brand new regulation, which was groundbreaking and had pretty tight penalties tied to the ways that companies use data. And so all of my work went to making sure that companies had data protections in place and were getting proper consents before storing data. And, you know, on the back end, working with engineers to make sure that, you know, if we're telling people in our privacy policy that we're deleting data after 10 years, that it's actually happening. Can we verify that? And so I was, you know, everything from drafting privacy policies to also combing through, and from an engineering standpoint, making sure that everything we say in the privacy policy is actually happening.
Wow. I mean, definitely law related, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Would you say that you had to have a JD to do that job?
No, I mean, you don't have to. You know, I've been in privacy now for like 6 years, and I would say that about 60 to 70% of the people who I work with are JDs.
Oh, okay.
But yeah. I know a lot of people who are not JDs who work alongside me and do well in privacy also. So it's a position, it's a role where JDs are highly preferred, not required. But I will say that as you get higher and higher, you see more lawyers. If you look at chief privacy officers, they are almost always lawyers. So it definitely helps to have that law degree for this career field.
Yeah. Okay. What do you love about your work now?
Oh, man. I love, number one, the lifestyle. That's important to me, right? I didn't know it was until later. So I harp on that. I want people to think about whether that's important to them too while they're young. But I love the lifestyle, number one, of working in tech and the freedom and the autonomy. But about privacy in particular, I love that there is this clean slate to be extremely creative in building things. You know, you get to build things. Your clients come to you and they aren't saying, can you help me argue with this person? Can you help me negotiate and like get a great deal? They're saying, we are going to launch this new AI algorithm. Can you help us build it in a privacy forward way? And so you're building cool things. You know, you're not taking from anyone at any time.
Right? A zero sum game of,
Right. Like I never feel like I'm like taking something or trying to get one over on somebody. And it just naturally fits with my personality. I'm a creative person. I mentioned that in addition to all the work that I do, I'm a ceramic artist as well. And so I'm a creative person. So I get to bring that side of me to work and I get to build things, which is, I mean, there's a kid in all of us who liked building things, right? And being reconnected with that and also being able to really use my law degree every single day makes it just a really magical career for me.
Yeah. So there's no regret here then to going to law school because it's what led you to where you are.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. Like if you had known what you know now, would you have gone to law school again?
Yeah. Similar to another answer I gave. I mean, if you asked me that question in 2016, before I found privacy, I was in this space of why did I go to law school? Like now I got to figure out what to do with this expensive law degree because I paid for mine. And so, but now, 100% grateful that it worked out the way it is. Not only am I grateful that I went to law school, but I also, even though I ended up not liking litigation for a lot of reasons, I also am really grateful that I was a litigator. And I, you know, I speak to law students a lot. I'm an adjunct law professor, and I think everyone should be a litigator. It's extremely powerful. The skill sets you get as a litigator will carry you through your entire professional career. You know, you are basically learning how to take control of situations that are extremely sticky and thorny and have not only complex substantive issues, but also complex personalities.
Emotions are running high.
And no matter what career you choose, that's a huge asset.
Yeah, I could see that being a huge asset. What are some of the tactics that you're using today that you learned a while ago, or I imagine continuing to refine?
Right. Well, when I was at my law firm, although I was only there for, you know, I was there for a little under 2 years, it was a mid-sized firm. So I got to take and defend depositions pretty early on and argue motions in court. And so I understand how to advocate for myself at work, right? Like you mentioned the headline of quadrupling my income because I took a big pay cut when I went into privacy from recruiting. And no one handed me $400,000, right? I've advocated for myself very strongly in my one-on-one meetings with managers. I'm managing them. I'm saying, this is what I want here, so I'm going to get there. You know, how are you going to help me do this? And I know how to have those conversations in my career, but also just even with the substantive work that I do, I'm often working with product managers and engineers. And as you can imagine, I work in privacy. And I think everyone thinks it's important, but no one really wants to do it, right? Whenever my team wants to launch something, they just want to launch. And I have to get them to slow down. Like maybe they want to launch in February. And I'm like, you need to build this tool and you can't launch until March, but I'm not their boss. I have to be able to influence them without having authority over them.
Yeah.
And I use a ton of my litigation skill sets and being able to do that. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I use my litigation skill sets every single day. And I think it is the most valuable experience that I had, even though I ultimately, didn't like it for a lot of reasons, not only the culture, but, there were a lot of things about litigation that didn't end up just, syncing up for me. But I still think it's a really, really valuable place to start out.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So we're usually telling people to run as far away as they can from law unless they are magnetically drawn to it on some level. And you're saying, well, there's something about the skills of becoming a litigator or learning about becoming a litigator that you just find invaluable and you would hope everyone could get exposed to at some point.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So you've worked at Meta, right? Google, and then I think I read Cruise. I'm assuming that's the self-driving tech company. It's not a company I'm very familiar with, but these all sound like tech companies that can also have, right, a culture of working a lot.
Right.
Is it what? It's different though. Or it's
yeah, it is. I mean, I've been able to manage my career kind of autonomously, frankly. I mean, you get a lot of autonomy in tech when you're not an engineer. Now, here's the deal. I can't fix anything. Right?
Here's a problem. Good luck. Thank you.
No, so I won't say that everyone in tech is enjoying weekends and evenings, right? But in the roles that I do, if there's a big problem, terminology that is used in the industry is a SEV. That means something broke, right? There was a SEV 1, 2, or 3.
SEV, what does that stand for?
Yeah. I actually am not sure what SEV stands for. I'm trying to at some point, but now I just call them SEVs, right?
Okay.
And so when you're on a product team and there's a SEV 1, 2, or 3, that's how you rate the severity of it. And that's when sometimes product managers, engineers, I don't care if they're in Hawaii, they have to fix this SEV because Instagram is not working, right?
Yeah,
and we can
have
Instagram just not working.
And everybody's upset, yeah.
Right, it's on the Today Show and someone has to fix this. And, but I don't really have to do that.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing that I control. And so there are certain times. I won't say that I am just, sitting here reading my Kindle all day every day and filing my nails, right? I definitely have weeks where I work more than other weeks, especially if there's a new privacy regulation that has come out that we have a deadline to comply with and we have to get a lot of engineering work done. I'm program managing, making sure that the engineer is talking to legal and policy and the comms team and whoever else needs to be involved to launch something in a privacy forward way. And so I have busy weeks, but frankly, it's I know for the most part on Monday what I have to get done on Friday, and I'm able to carve out a to-do list for the week that allows me to do that in a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah, that's awesome. I want to talk a little bit about your professional network. We encourage people who listen to this show to start developing that as much as they can, often just through LinkedIn or whatnot, because there is the networks are so powerful. I think you probably know this much better than I do, but I'm just thinking about people who are deciding whether or not to go to law school. You can talk to people, just sitting down and having coffee or something could be eye-opening. not to mention the job opportunities that may or may not come later from someone who is even just slightly invested in your success. It sounds like networking has done a lot for you.
It has. I mean, it has done it is the most important thing that, you know, will propel anyone's career. But I think, especially it's important for law students to know this and people who are considering law school, is that you'll hear this a lot, but your first job means absolutely nothing. It means nothing. Like, I am, you know, over a decade out of law school now, and I have friends who are extremely successful in a lot of different industries, from fashion to C-suite executives, you know, film, media, tech, like myself. And there's not much correlation between people's first job and where they end up in their law careers. There just isn't. So, you know, what I say that to say, focus on building your network in law school, make friends. Make as many friends as possible. That is what law school is about. Who cares about that first job? Like, snap yourself out of that as early as you possibly can. There's a ton of noise about this in law school, but I just tell people, tune it out. It doesn't matter. Who cares? Because what you're going to need ultimately is your network. And for me, I created that entirely organically. I, you know, as I mentioned, when I decided to law school, I didn't know a lawyer. I mean, this all came from my TV impersonations of, or, you know, understandings of what a lawyer does. And so I created a very robust network entirely from scratch, heavily using LinkedIn to do two things in tandem. One is write content. It doesn't have to be good. Doesn't have to be long, but write content on LinkedIn that shows excitement about the area of law that you're interested in. It doesn't have to be mean that you're writing content and that you're saying, I'm the expert in privacy, real estate, whatever it is you want to do. Just showing excitement about the area you're interested in. And then also just making connections on LinkedIn. Reach out to people, especially students. I tell students, you have a superpower as a student. You can contact anyone and they will meet with you.
Yeah, you don't have it. Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. It's almost like as a student, they don't expect you to have this big resume.
Right.
And so you get a little bit of a pass for reaching out to people that otherwise you might not be able to reach out to. Okay, interesting.
Right. You know, I mean, you can build, and it's what I did. You can build a killer network. Like, if you know you want to go to privacy or, you know, practice privacy or litigation, real estate, whatever it is, go on LinkedIn and write a message to every chief privacy officer, chief legal officer, and say, I'm a law student. I just want to know. Like, I can't do that.
Yeah.
They're going to be like, get out of here.
Yeah. Yeah.
But as a law student or a student at all, you have this like clean slate where everyone's going to talk to you. And the work it takes to maintain relationships is very light. It's not like then you meet with them and you have to talk to them every day. I mean, once a year, say Happy New Year, right? Like, and that minimal amount of effort pays off in dividends. For me, it got me my first job in privacy. This was from, you know, making connections on LinkedIn. And then, you know, just going back to those people who I had connected with and done informational interviews with and just saying, hey, thanks for talking to me 6 months ago. I did the things you recommended that I do, because people will say, you know, here's what you should do if you're interested. So you have to prove that you've done
those
things.
And you want to do that, right? You don't want to blow that off. Like, okay.
And then ask for something. Hey, like, I'm on the job market now, or I'm interested in this. Can you connect me with someone who has a privacy job? Right.
But
it's, you know, it doesn't take that heavy of a lift to build these relationships. No one really wants to talk to you every day. Like, they don't want the person who's going to nag them. But if you know someone and then you're writing some content, so you're visible, and then maybe once a year you keep in touch, that's frankly enough. When I got my most recent job, this is a true story. You know, you mentioned I was at Cruise for a brief period, and I was, because Cruise had a mass layoff right after I joined. It's in the news everywhere. The CEO has resigned a couple months ago, and they laid off about 20% of the company, including leaders in my organization. And so I didn't even have my resume updated. I sent a message to about three people who I know on LinkedIn and got interviews and had an offer within a week, you know, and that's happened in the past for me too. And it's just because of that network, you know, people will associate you with that, with like a pretty minimal amount of work.
Yeah, you're coming to them when you don't have this immense need, as opposed to waiting until you have the need and then trying to make connections. Interesting. What any other advice you have to people when people who are in undergrad right now, people who are going to law school soon?
Yeah, there's so much. I think we've you know, we've covered so much. I think I would just reiterate the one thing that I think students don't think about is when you're thinking about the career you want, really think about the lifestyle too, and don't underestimate that. You know, don't say that you're willing to be unhappy for a certain amount of money, because you can make a lot of money and be happy. So just be more intentional about it and think about what you want to do, and then be strategic in crafting your way to a certain dollar amount that's important to you in that area that is really organic to who you are.
Yeah. I imagine a lot of people listening to that might say, well, how do I be strategic about it? But I think even just trying to be strategic is going to be a huge leg up, right? Because so much of, so many of these decisions are just made quickly. Like, oh, this is what I'm going to do. Like even just spending a little bit of time chatting with ChatGPT could maybe nudge you in a wildly different direction than...
Right. That's a whole other AI conversation, right? That I have all the time. But yeah, I mean, the one thing that I would recommend in terms of like, you know, being intentional is informational interviews. That's an intentional action where you're going to walk away from every one of those learning something. And so if you're interested in an area of law or in law at all, just go on LinkedIn, craft a 3 to 4 sentence email. ChatGPT can probably write this email for you. You know,
Hey,
my name is Joe. I'm interested in privacy. I'm a law student. I'd love 15 minutes of your time. Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You send that to 20 people. Look, they're not all going to respond, but you're going to get a good amount of responses and you're going to have great conversations. And in those conversations, the number one thing you want to understand from people is what does it take to be, you know, good in their career fields. And the second thing you want to understand is what should you do now to prepare yourself for that? And just ask those questions in these 15, 20 minute phone calls. You're going to have that's going to create your strategy for you. You're not going to know your strategy. If you're in college right now and you're 19, 20, 21, no, I mean, it would be, you don't have the visibility of the life experience to say exactly sometimes like how to get from there to chief, whatever. Right. You can spend a lot of time spinning wheels, but there's an easier way. Ask the people who have done it and then create a rubric based on what they're telling you and what you're extracting from those conversations.
So to repeat, you're doing these informational interviews, you're reaching out to say 20 people, maybe 5 get back to you, you hop on Zoom, and your goal in those 15 minutes is to learn, hey, what is it you're doing and what does it take to be good at that? And then how do I get there?
Right. Yeah, exactly. What do I do between now and, you know, X date, like law school graduation or whatever, to get to where you are? Those are important, powerful things. That's what I did when I decided to go to privacy. I was a recruiter at that time. I knew nothing about privacy other than what these job descriptions said, right? And I went to every privacy lawyer who would talk to me on LinkedIn and just had these very humbling conversations. Some of them were younger than I was, right? And for me at that time, the resounding advice that I got was to write about it, because privacy in particular is evolving so constantly that the only way to master it is to be writing about it as it's happening. And that's how you show that you're an expert at it too. And so that advice paid off hugely. I started writing about privacy on LinkedIn. If you go to my LinkedIn, you'll see things from 5 and 6 years ago about privacy. I wasn't an expert then at all. I had just started, but that's how I got into Facebook. I never applied to Facebook.
They reached out to you.
Yeah, they reached out because I was so active in the privacy community on LinkedIn, and they said, "Hey, would you like to work here?" And I was a consultant. I said, "Yeah, I'll definitely interview." You know, and that led me to Google and to Amazon, and so that is squarely. I wouldn't have known to do that, right? That's advice that I got from informational interviews. So those are really powerful tools to help you create and execute that strategic plan to craft a career that really fits who you actually are, and make money, which is important.
Wow. I mean, it's just, if anyone listening now can just do some of these, right? The information they're going to get from that is going to dramatically change how they spend their time, how they pursue law school if they end up doing that, how well they do in law school. Wow, I hope people take your advice. Janaea, do you have time to talk a little bit about negotiating, or do you need to get going?
No, yeah, I have some time. Yep, I'm all
okay.
Yours.
I'd love to talk about that because it is something that comes up a lot on the show, right? So we're trying to get people to do as well as they can on the LSAT. That often means taking it multiple times because schools take your highest score. So get over this idea that I got to do it one time and do it perfectly and be done. No, you can take it up to five times. So we're encouraging people not to just go take it, but to get prepared as best they can, then go take it. If it's not the best score they could have gotten, to take it again, because if they can bring that score up, then that gives them negotiating leverage when asking for scholarships and so forth. But even then, right, some schools, they're experts at this. They do this every day. They do it hundreds of times a day. They negotiate with their potential applicants. And so you have people who are coming in and they've never done this before, and we're trying to encourage them to negotiate effectively. And that includes understanding their value and applying broadly so that they can get lots of offers and start to see who's really interested in them and not feel trapped. But they want to know, like, how do I ask for more money without being rude? And when should I stop? Should I ask now? Should I wait until I have more offers?
Right.
Thoughts on any of that?
Yeah, definitely. That is such a good question. And, you know, I think a lot of what holds people back from asking those conversations is fear, mm-hmm. right? Fear of 100%. How it's going to sound, fear of, is now the right time to ask this, and fear because there may be repercussions. But the advice I would give, having done a ton of negotiating, you know, I can talk about that a little later, but nothing bad's going to happen if you ask for what you want. You know, like, nothing bad's going to happen. Like, they're not going to like rescind your acceptance, right? You can only learn mm-hmm. more information. You can only hear a yes or a maybe. That's the only thing that could happen from this conversation you're having, no matter how you say it, right? Of course, the way you say it matters. You want to be as impactful as possible. But even if you totally like send an email that does come off rude or stern because you didn't get the tone right, like, they're still not going to rescind your acceptance to this law school. Like, there is no fear of something going wrong in these negotiations. I mentioned I was a recruiter for 3 years, and the way that that works is when you're a recruiter, you are negotiating all the time because I was at an agency and I worked for, you know, I got job orders from law firms and corporations, and they were needing attorneys or groups of attorneys. And so I would give them the candidate and I would handle the negotiation if they wanted one of my candidates. So, I mean, I have been in that 3 years I mentioned, you know, I had a team of, you know, 20 to 25, you know, recruiters working under me, thousands of negotiations over 3 years, truly. And I've never seen anything go wrong because someone asked for what they wanted. And so the same thing applies to like jobs, right? People are afraid to counter big. They're afraid the offer is going to be rescinded. It's not, you know? So I would say decide what you want, like, and ask for it. If you're applying to law school, right, at the point that you're applying, you've already written the essay, you've already taken the LSAT. You know that you are a valuable law student at this point, right? I don't have to tell you that. And so, lean in on that and just ask for what you want with no fear, because nothing bad is going to happen if you get it wrong.
Worst case, they say no.
Right, exactly.
We don't want to give you any more money.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. We don't have any more money. We don't want to give you any more. Or, and you can always think of follow-up questions to ask. It's like, you're not going to bother them so much that you're like, that they write you another letter and say, please throw away the packet we sent you before. You are now no longer accepted. So you can only get more money or more information.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, more information. Like, so say that you get information from one, you know, law school, because you're going to apply to multiple schools, right? And so say you do like totally mess it up with like Penn, right? And you're like, oh, that went terribly. Like, you learn from that. And then the next law school you talk to, you change your approach, right?
Yes, because of that experience. Okay.
Right. Or you might learn about, you know, like, maybe they'll say, you know, we don't have we can't offer you a fluoride, but here's what we do have instead, right? Like you can only learn information about like how to ask better next time, or other opportunities that could be good for you, right? Good things happen to people who ask for what they want, and that's in your career across the board. And again, it goes back to the article. That's how I got to quadrupling my salary in 5 years, right? Because you just boldly ask for what you want, and nothing bad ever happens when you do that.
Okay. Well, that's a good idea to keep in your head. Nothing bad ever happens when you ask for what you want. So, it's almost like even if it goes terribly, right? You ask all these schools for more money, none of them give you anything that you want. Well, I guess at the very least you're learning something, right?
You're learning that you're not going to get into those law schools for free, right? You're learning that maybe you should look at the B list of schools, right? Like, or that maybe, you might be interested in doing something else. Like, if your only reason to law school was to get it for free and you can't get it there for free, then maybe you take the GMAT. Like, I don't know. You learn something, right? Or you could learn that you still love it and that you want to do it anyway, and that you have learned about all these careers because you've also been doing your informational interviews and been like, I mean, look, I don't want you to pay for law school or anything, but you can pay off law school debt, right? Like I had a partial scholarship, but I paid for part of my law school and it's paid off. I don't even think about that anymore. So you can learn something. You like there is no terrible outcome. It's like, what is the terrible outcome when you consider the alternative of not asking? I can't think of a terrible outcome.
No, that's a very good point. And also, you're never going to really interact with these people again, right? Like, you're talking to the admissions office. You're not even talking to the people you're going to end up talking to when you go to school, let alone your professors or anything like that.
Yeah, you don't even see them. I think my 3 years of law school, like they're in another building, they're busy, they're not around. Like, yeah, you won't know these people.
I'm almost hearing that the value, or one of the values in negotiating for your law school tuition, is not only that you will get, or most likely get, better offers and therefore pay less for law school, but also you're just starting to develop a habit, a persona. We talked about that at the very beginning of the show, like a lifestyle in which you're comfortable asking for things, which I can't imagine. I can't imagine a legal career in which you don't develop those skills. I mean, isn't that the definition probably of law? Like, figuring out how to, I mean, even a transactional attorney who sits behind a desk and never has to, you have to write a document that's going to ask for things from the other party.
And sometimes outrageous things, and that actually ties back to why I think litigation is so important, right? Because you get used to having to ask for things and advocate all of the time, and you're not advocating all like always what you think makes sense. Sometimes your client is like, "Say this number," and you're like, "What? That's outrageous!" And you have to go in there and confidently say this crazy number, to a room full of opposing counsel in black suits or whatever, and you are a junior attorney. And so that's the same if it's corporate law and you're doing a real estate deal or commercial transaction, right? You have to be comfortable asking for things no matter what kind of law you go into. And if your goal going to law school is to make money, like you have to be comfortable asking for things for that too, just in terms of your own career, because not everyone just comes right out, gets into big law, and then wants to stay in big law.
Well said. I don't know what to add to that. Janaea, Gordon, what's the best way for people to reach out to you? Any parting words?
Parting words are thank you for having me. This is such a refreshing conversation. The best way to reach out to me is on my website, joneagordon.com. I'm also on LinkedIn, more often, I guess, than like Twitter and Instagram, but I'm on Twitter and Instagram too as Joneah Gordon underscore ESQ. But frankly, if someone wants to contact me, those are difficult things to like sift through. And my website is always the best way to actually contact me.
So you have a job at Amazon. Sorry, I know we're ending, but you have a website as well.
Yes.
So what's the purpose of the website?
I do career consulting for
Oh,
people
okay.
who mostly targeted towards like mid-career professionals like myself who want to change careers and are needing a guide in order to understand, how to map from point A to point B. So I offer, career consulting sessions for people in that position, mostly geared towards getting into tech without having a tech background, which is what I've done and what I know the most about.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for coming on the show. It was fun to talk to you. I'm sure so many people learned a lot. I know I did. Yeah. Thanks again. And
All right.
have a good
Wonderful.
Tuesday.
You
Yeah.
too. Bye.
All right. So we have a demon support question here. Why don't you read it?
Yeah, I'm coming in off the bench to do a couple of items before we wrap up the show.
Yeah.
Looking forward to listening to that interview. I haven't even listened to it yet. Let's see. Demon support question says, is it possible to get an experimental section of games now? Logically, I think it is not possible. If experimental sections are to test new questions and there are no new logic game sections to be made, then there can't be an experimental logic games section. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I wanted to hear what you thought about the phrase. Logically, I think it is not possible.
Well, I wouldn't say not possible, but I would definitely say not likely. I mean, so when I saw this, I immediately said, hey, Eric, put this on the agenda. The reason why is because I liked the thinking. I liked the rational, intuitive nature of this support question, right? It's like, yeah, I mean, if the purpose of the experimental section is to test out new questions, and if the games are going away, then why would they test new games? Now, that doesn't mean they can't test game-like stuff. And it doesn't mean that they can't, who knows? Like, I don't know what they're thinking. Maybe 5 years from now, they're going to go back to some other, probably not the logic games the way they used to exist. But they did, a year or two ago, what was it now, a year ago, that they tested those LR questions that were kind of like halfway between a game and an LR question, or it looked like an LR question, but it was very game-like. So, it's totally possible that when you open up your, I mean, you won't know that it's the experimental section, by the way, unless they tell you, which they normally don't tell you, except for the time that they did tell you that this is an experimental section. And by the way, when I say they, I mean the Law School Admission Council, the people who make the test. It's possible that you start section two or whatever, and it's the experimental section, but they don't tell you that it's the experimental section, and the stuff could look weird, right? They could just test brand new things, entirely brand new things. The whole point of, the experimental section doesn't count. So I think that's the thing that people really need to remember is that it just doesn't matter what they're testing on you because it doesn't count for your 120 to 180 score. So section one, section two, section three, section four, I think it could appear in any one of those places. And it could be, I think most likely it's going to be an additional experimental section of either LR or reading comp on the theory that they're going to be producing two new sections of LR and one new section of RC 9 times a year for the regularly scheduled LSAT. You would think that roughly it's going to be like a 2-to-1 ratio of new LR questions to new reading comp questions. But if they have an eye toward changing the test again in the future, then who knows what they might test on the experimental section. So you just kind of got to roll with it on the day of the test. You got to remember that, in your time allotted, you're supposed to just answer the questions that you can answer in that section, no matter what they are. And if you happen to be working on an experimental section, who cares? Because it's not going to count anyway.
Yeah, so we both agree that when this correspondent or this demon support student or this demon student who sent in a support question said, logically, I think it's not possible. We're both thinking it's possible. It's just not likely. And I would say that it would be pretty silly of them to do that because, boy, well, I guess, okay, we have what? Two more tests. We have the April test and then we have the June test. Those two tests are going to have games. So if they give you a games experimental section, you'll have two. You won't know which one is the experimental. But after that, right, it would be extraordinarily silly for them to give you logic games because you would immediately know that that was the experimental section.
Oh, that too. Yeah, right.
And then you would just immediately ignore it until, you know, even if they're trying to test games for some future unknown test that we don't know about.
That reminds me of two things. One is, oh God, I lost my train of thought on the first thing. Well, I just heard from a 1L who said that they had midterms. It's one of these schools where you only get your grades at the end of the year. You know, like there's no first semester
end of the
grades,
semester.
Really. It's just end of the year. Yeah, one grade.
Oh, I didn't know about these schools. So what's happening? They're doing one class for the whole year? I thought we reset the semester.
No, but I mean, you have torts for the whole year, right? You have contracts for the whole year.
I don't remember any of this. I blacked it out. This is all like gone from me now. I don't even remember. So wait,
I didn't black
true?
It out. I just didn't go. That's why I don't remember.
Okay. Yeah.
Also, I was drinking too much at the time, so I definitely don't remember. So just grading shenanigans and ridiculousness of what law school professors do. So they had a midterm at the end of the first semester.
Mm-hmm.
And it was allegedly 15% of your grade, except if you score higher on the final, then only your final counts.
Wow.
So
what's your
well, I mean, if you think that through, it's like, well, okay, so then if I really kill it on the midterm, then it can help me. But otherwise, 85% of my grade is going to be the final anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And if I do better on the final, then my midterm counts for zero. And so what some smartasses would do is they would just not even do the midterm.
Yeah. Boy, that sounds like a really smart ass move. And by smart ass, I mean dumb, right? Like, I would like to get the feedback that I don't know what the fuck I'm doing.
Right. Right.
And that 15% could be worth gold because it could make your 100%. Yeah. Anyways.
And I think that that's, of course, that's what, you know, 95% of the students are going to do. But there are those who slip through the cracks, right? There are the Nathan Foxes circa 2008 who somehow end up
you,
in
Nathan?
Law school. And well, no, because I would just be like, my goal every time I was in school was I'm going to do the bare minimum to get my degree. That's it. Yeah. I don't know. That's my parents didn't go to college. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing, right? So I'm just like, well, hey, if you're going to grant me the degree, then I'm going to get the degree. So great. So like I would have just been like, go on vacation, just skip the midterms entirely and just, oh, well, you know, I'll get it done on the final. Apparently, I guess that's what happened. Some people like skipped the final entirely in previous years. So then they had made a rule that said, but you do have to do it. Then what happened was,
and what will happen if you don't? Like,
well, yeah. Then what happened was some smartasses or dumbasses, wrote song lyrics, like just sat there for the whole time and just like wrote out, you know, lyrics from Tupac or whatever. And probably not Tupac, that might get you kicked out of school. Anyway, they just wrote a bunch of song lyrics and then, so then the rule is, and also you can't just do that. You have to do it and you have to do it earnestly. Then if you do it earnestly and you really fuck it up, then it doesn't matter. Then it counts for zero. But you have to do it earnestly.
I'm really like, I'm perplexed here. I mean, you got the dumbasses who are sitting there writing Tupac lyrics or something else. But then like law professors making this rule that you have to do it, like just tie a consequence to it, right? What? Just increase the value of the midterm or something.
Why make it actually count. Just make it 15% of your grade. I mean, that's my thing. Like, why don't you just have it be 15% of your
why
grade?
Why this weird, oh, but you got to do it. You got to do it sincerely. Well, I don't think you did it sincerely here. So what? Then what happens?
Right. Yeah. It reminds me of me in high school. Because, you know, I was a smartass / dumbass from a relatively early age. And I remember in my history class, the teacher told us that we had homework due tomorrow, and I'm going to give you the class period to work on it. So what do I do? Throw it in my trapper keeper and then like just start bullshitting with my friends.
Yeah. I don't have to do it now, right?
You said it's due tomorrow. If it's due tomorrow, then it's due tomorrow. Like, leave me alone, right? No, no, but you have to work on it now. Yeah, okay, but it's due tomorrow. So I'm talking to my friends. Thanks. I'll hand it in tomorrow. Okay, it's due tomorrow if you work on it in class. But if you don't work on it in class, then it's due now. That's what the history teacher said. And I was like, so then, you know, just imagine me at this dark 17 cloud. Or 16 or whatever. Yeah. And I'm just like furious about the injustice of it. And it's like so fucked up. And you said it was due tomorrow. And, you know, well, I mean, because it is really patronizing, right? I mean, that type of thing is like, okay, so what's the point of this again? Like, you just don't want to teach us. You want us to shut up and work quietly.
Yeah, it's, I'm going to tell you what to do and how to do it, which is just over the top unnecessary.
Well, like, allegedly, I'm going to grade you on your end product. But also, if you don't pretend to be doing it in the way that I want you to do it, then it's not, it, well, anyway.
Why did we start talking about this?
I don't know. We were talking about whether LSAC would test new logic games via the experimental section. And I do agree with you. It seems very unlikely that they would do it. And we do have that one weird instance, though, of where they, you know, it's the only time that it ever happened, as far as we know, at least in the last 15 years that I've been teaching LSAT or that you've been teaching LSAT. They did it exactly one time where at the top of the section it said, hey, this is an experimental section. And then that's when they tested those weird kind of LR, kind of logic games questions.
I wonder how good the data was that they gathered from that experimental section, given that there would be not just dumbasses, but smartasses who would just take a break.
Right. I mean, you could very legitimately at that point have just gone B, 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 finish and take a nap for 35 minutes.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have done that. I would have like had fun playing with the questions, you know.
But some people would, right? They'd say, hey, I'm going to save my energy for the real sections. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Well, anyway. Okay.
Thank you, whoever wrote that in. I appreciate that question. But yeah, I think your logic is pretty sound. I would have just dumbed down the conclusion here, right? Like, just dial back your conclusion.
Softened it. Yeah. Softened it, right?
Yeah. This could be a great argument if you said, logically, I think it's unlikely.
Even highly unlikely. Like, it's nearly impossible.
Yeah, nearly impossible. That'd be good.
But not impossible.
Yeah. Cool.
All right, let's go to words of the week. We have a word from you, Nathan, avuncular. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, avuncular. I was reading the sequel to The Handmaid's Tale. It's called The Testaments, Margaret Atwood. I'm still amazed that she wrote a sequel to that book. It's a kind of a classic, right? And she wrote it 30 years ago. And then she wrote a sequel like 30 years later.
Yeah.
So, and I'm enjoying both. I enjoyed both books, but I ran across this word avuncular, and I could get it from context at the time, but I was kind of surprised. Are you familiar with this word?
No, not at all.
Okay. Anything in there that you see that makes, you know, like if you had to guess what it meant without looking it up?
I've already looked it up, so I'd be totally cheating, but it sounds like uncle.
Yeah, you're right, Ben. The first definition of avuncular is suggestive of an uncle, especially in kindliness or geniality.
Okay.
And so I think
so uncles are kind, I guess. Yeah, I can. Yeah.
Generally, I'm an uncle, and I would say that I'm pretty kind and genial to my nieces and nephew. I really enjoy being an uncle. And so I had known that word kind of meant friendly, I had seen it in context a million times. And okay. I knew that it meant, you know, I don't know. I thought it meant like chatty, friendly, easygoing, maybe kindly or something. But then when I looked it up and I saw that it's suggestive of an uncle, especially in kindliness or geniality, I was like, oh, holy shit. Okay, well, and it's right there in the actual word. So I thought that was interesting. Anyway.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. Here, let's read this one sentence. Jovial and avuncular. The president's chief of staff seems oblivious to the pressures that accompany what is arguably the second most powerful job in the land. Okay, so this person is overly nice for such a demanding job, maybe?
Yeah, right. If it's telling you, well, I mean, there, you know, from context, you could get it as, okay, so jovial and avuncular, even if you don't know what avuncular means at all, you could say, oh, well, I know what jovial means. And jovial means basically the same thing, right? Friendly, happy, whatever. And then when it says, comma, the president's chief of staff seems oblivious to the pressures. Oh, so jovial and avuncular must be the opposite of what we would expect someone to be when they have the second most powerful job in the land, which I guess might be grave and serious.
Serious and
yeah.
Depressed.
Angry. Yeah.
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 Okay. Cool. Well, this next work is word is from Eric. Anime, maybe?
Anime. And so now, oh, okay. And we do have a piece of context here. The paraphrased quote is, the music evoked feelings of alienation and anime. Oh yeah, I remember that reading comprehension passage. So what would you do there if you had no clue what anime meant?
Well, definitely think that it must, or most likely, not must, most likely mean something along the lines of alienation. Something similar. Yeah. Totally. I mean, that's why the LSAT's doing that, right?
Yeah, there's two examples in a row of where context sometimes, if they, you know, if they just say that someone was if they say X and Y.
Yep.
I don't know. If you don't know what X means, you can just look at Y. And if you don't know what Y means, you could just look at X. If you don't know what either of them mean, then maybe you're in kind of trouble. Although I do think I remember that from this particular passage, it was talking about how this music, for listeners who weren't familiar with that type of music or that type of sound or whatever, they didn't like it. It evoked feelings of alienation and anime. Oh, okay. So it, you know, I know what alienation means. I listen to it and I go, ew, this is not for me. It seems different from me. The only other thing I would notice about anime is that I think that that prefix of A-N, or maybe it's just the A prefix, but I think that that suggests opposition.
Yeah, like antagonistic, animosity, antipathy, which is a word we talked about before. Yeah.
It's super similar to animosity anyway, because it starts with the same two letters, has a lot of the similar. I don't know if they're related at all, but there are so many times where like a sound alike word really is pretty much capturing the gist of it. So yeah, here I would say that anime means probably something like alienation. It probably means something bad. Yes. I don't know. Hatred, bad. Maybe?
Maybe. Yeah. What's the definition?
So Merriam-Webster says, social instability resulting from a breakdown of standards and values, like the reforms of a ruined economy under these conditions brought about social anomie, desperation, and poverty. Again, a list, right? An anomie might mean something like desperation, poverty. And then the second definition here says also it might mean personal unrest, alienation, and uncertainty that comes from a lack of purpose or ideals. So the example there is, In the face of these prevailing values, many workers experience a kind of anomy. Their jobs become empty, meaningless, and intrinsically unsatisfying. I'm noticing now that anomy also is a lot like enemy, you know, again, with like the sound alike. It's just like, well, I don't know. It sounds kind of bad to me. I don't think that that's like, that's not going to work all the time, but I'm just looking for as many clues as I can get. And sometimes it works out.
I'm trying to think about alienation too. What's interesting about words is you know what they mean, but then when you look up the definitions, sometimes it forces you to reflect on them a little bit more, right? Alienation means to separate, to feel separated, right? Or distant from. And anomy is talking about feelings of like unrest or instability, both personally or socially. Those, it's like you're being alienated or disconnected from your values or something, right?
Yeah. Interesting that you say something there, because that is a tip that I know Ala uses in a lot of her reading comprehension classes. Is that if you're not sure what a word means, you know, you could try to get it from the root or really think about that word, see what kinds of things it's similar to. But another trick is to just put something in that spot, because if they did give you one of these ands, then you could say something, then it's like, well, okay, so I don't know what anomy means, but in the context of the example that we were given, yeah, in the example that we were given, when it says the music evoked feelings of alienation and anomy, instead you could say the music evoked feelings of alienation and something. Well, if it's making me feel alienation, that's clearly not good.
Yeah.
So what could anime mean? Like, anime probably doesn't mean warm, fuzzy feelings.
Well, and the word that just came to me now when you said that, alienation and something, may be disconnected, which is not too far off from the definition.
Yeah. And all you're really doing there is just using alienation again, right?
Yes,
you're just kind of thinking of like what are other words for alienation, and it might be something like loneliness, it might be something like sadness, I don't know, but it probably is not warm fuzzy feelings. It's probably something bad because of the thing that it's riding along with.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, I think that's enough for words of the week.
Likewise. I wanted to thank Janaea Gordon for coming on the show again. Lots of good advice for our listeners. Nathan, I'll be excited to hear what you have to think once you hear that interview. Be LSAT famous. Please ask questions or share news with us at LSAT Demon. If you have questions about the demon itself, you can email our great help team at help@lsatdemon.com. Also, check out our other podcast. That's LSAT Demon Daily. Subscribe on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. It helps us immensely. That was episode 437 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing ya. Don't pay for law school.